Now here we go. As you've undoubtedly aware, there's a whole school of thought in our world that they're evil. And they wouldn't disagree with that for a minute. Dark side and evil are complicated issues. We make the dark side evil by the way we deal with it, and the grays will test you and test you and test you. The more you work with the dark side, the more successful you are, the darker they get. Until you find the only thing is surrender.
Because I cannot do a thing about this. I don't even want to look up at this. Can we help you stop screaming? Can we help you stop screaming?
I mean, I remember last summer, Paul Krugman, the famous, or I don't know how famous he is, but he's a writer for the New York Times and economist, very well respected, very, very intelligent guy. He actually made the assertion that the economy could benefit. I just pulled it up right now. It says Nobel laureate economist Paul Krugman repeated his assertion this week, this is last summer, that the United States could benefit economically if the government began pouring money into anti-ET defense in preparation for a possible alien invasion of Earth.
Wow. Yeah.
And then surprisingly, you had all sorts of other pundits and intellectuals agreeing. I mean, it was one of the craziest things I'd ever heard, but it ties in directly with what you were saying.
Sure does. Do they know something we don't then, or what? just in case?
You know, and this is not some crazy person. This is Nobel laureate, New York Times.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the same thing I found hard grasping about Kurzweil, which is a highly thought of, you know, socially influential individual who's talking insanity, from what I can decipher all that. But it could be, yeah, I mean, this is the future. I mean, how do we know that, like, if enough people believe it and act on it and society reforms itself around that, it doesn't mean it'll be what they say it is, because it may, you know, this is the thing about crucial fiction. It's crucial to your survival. You will make it real. You'll create the fantasy in a way that it's all inclusive and all embracive, and that you forget that you invented it.
So if we're all dependent on on the economy, and the economy is collapsing, then the economy needs a crucial fiction to survive.
Mm-hmm.
And that becomes our sort of number one priority.
Well, maybe, you know, maybe the space race was because initially it was a space race, so they had the communist thing to fuel it. The communist threat was fueling it.
Or it was a cover story. I mean, well, yeah, but go ahead.
Okay, I mean, yeah, that's the conspiracy theory that the Soviets and the U.S. were actually colonizing space together. And all that was just, you know, it was just the fiction that was created to justify the budget. But in any event, they don't have that fiction anymore. And it was right about, well, it was right about the time. I mean, I guess it was right about the time, actually, that communism collapsed, that the environmental thing really took off. And that is now, although it hasn't yet sort of resuscitated, oh, I don't know if it has, I don't keep close enough eye on it, but like the interest in space colonization, it seems like it's pretty strong to me, but that's because I've been researching it. But I couldn't say, like, in terms of just the general sort of climate, you know, how much it's been growing over the past few years, but I suspect it has been. And I suspect that people like Whitley and The Key, books like The Key, are going to become more and more kind of familiar to people, or the ideas, rather, that they're propagating are going to become more and more familiar to people. And it's just this basic idea that the planet can't support us, and so we have to support the space colonization program. And it may be that it's all a fiction, that even the space colonization is a fiction. They just need to prop up the economy.
Yeah. What year did Gore's documentary, The Inconvenient Truth, I'm trying to remember when that came out. Like,
it was mid-2000s, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, I tried to watch it and failed. And interesting you mentioned it, because I tried and more or less succeeded to watch Sirius recently, and it reminded me of Gore's Inconvenient Truth, actually. It had a similar sort of urgency, platforming kind of tone to it.
Just as I would suspect.
Oh, you haven't watched it?
No. But I had a friend who was so taken by the Inconvenient Truth film a few years back that he was burning DVDs and sending them to, you know, every person he knew. And he was just obsessed. I was just like, wow, okay.
It gave him a reason to live, huh?
Yeah. Really. He's an older guy.
Hmm. Well, everybody wants to be part of something bigger, I suppose.
Yeah.
You know? Everybody wants a cause, because just getting up in the morning just to wipe your ass and eat food and, you know, the stuff that we do, it's nice to feel inspired by something. I'm speaking personally, you know, directly from, like, having put a lot into this Crucial Fictions project, and then it kind of finishing it, and I'm continuing obviously with these other media, but essentially the period in which it was taking up my every moment and I really felt fired up with this cause has passed, and I sunk into quite a severe depression afterwards. I'm not saying it's directly or exclusively related, because it was also stirring up a lot of stuff which I think I'm now processing, but there is just that more superficial thing. If we have some sort of cause that is bigger than us, it really does put the wind in our sails.
You know, I just keep returning back to Nietzsche, and first of all, the death of God. That seems to be a critical piece of this puzzle, and why we're in the sort of state that we're in right now. And then one of his other fundamental ideas is the Superman or the Overman, which, you know, could be interpreted as the transhuman.
Yeah, absolutely. And the alien, both.
Mm.
Well, I think, I mean, this is far in the future, my own personal future in terms of this project, because it's in part two if I ever get to it, but there is a movement towards, in the material, the literature and the rest of it, towards fusing transhumanism with the alien paradigm. Because transhumanists are not into aliens, right? And alien people are not, UFO people aren't into transhumanism generally. Not that they're at war or anything, they're not counter-religions, but they're different, Sims Bainsbury's calls audience cults. An audience cult is you and I, right? It's the general populace, and they are, it's kind of like a fuel source. Consciousness to power the engine of civilization, of societies.
But my guess is that most of them are, of both camps, are atheists.
Yeah. Well, I don't know about the abductees. I mean, because they wouldn't be atheists. They're non-religious types. Because Christians tend to see the aliens as UFOs. I even found that out firsthand when I was... What did I say?
UFOs.
UFOs as demons is what I meant.
Demons,
to say.
Okay.
Yeah, they see them as demons. It's kind of that's part of their belief system, largely. But UFO types, as I'm sure you know, tend to be very New Age, and they're all into they just like to. E.T. overlords have replaced angelic beings, really. That's how they see them. It's even in the Sirius thing, which you would think would be somewhat more scientific minded, it didn't seem at all to me. They were going up into the desert to create circles and meditate and call down the beings, just like in the Cloud 2 song, you know, calling occupants.
Well, Greer is insistent on seeing the visitors as our space brothers, as well as having some pretty, I guess, you know, New Agey sort of. Although he doesn't really talk about that a lot, but it's there.
Well, as far as I can see, that's their method, really. That's their method for sort of corroborating these experiences and actually making it practical in some way. They go out in the desert and they meditate and they call down the Space Brothers.
Yep.
So it seemed to me they've sort of adopted the worst of... both worlds, like this nuts and bolts, this kind of pseudo-scientific approach where these are nuts and bolts crafts and they're extraterrestrial beings, they've kept it in a strictly scientific paradigm on the one hand, and then on the other hand, the worst kind of mysticism where they're just taking this very sort of passive-active approach of just open yourself to them and let them possess you, and they will bless you with their wonderful manna from heaven, kind of woolly-minded, New Age, wishful thinking. So if that's not a paradigm for the future, if that's not a Trojan horse for some sort of social implementation of this, you know, new political structures, I don't know what is.
Yeah, combining, as you say, the I don't even know really how to put it. What exactly are they getting out of science? The sort of literalism. Right. That we're dealing with flesh and blood, sort of biological entities.
Yeah, with machines, technology, and they've even got their little corpse to dissect, their little alien corpse.
Right. Which I think has already been shown to have been wholly human DNA.
Well, that's what Whitley said on his website. It looked just like something you'd get in a cracker to me.
In a cracker?
you know, those things you pull on Christmas Day and the little gift falls out. Something on the end of a keychain.
Right.
Or like Phil's alien. I mean, not
yeah.
exactly,
but yeah.
I mean, about as real as that.
One thing I wanted to bring up about the Kurzweil and the singularity, I wonder, because it made me, when I was reading the piece and that came up, it made me think of McKenna and his singularity, the whole his software that he developed. He and his brother developed this software, that Time Wave Zero, that's what it was called. And novelty was supposed to reach its ultimate expression around 2012.
Oh, yeah.
But that was a type of singularity idea. But I guess that, I don't know, does that have any relation to Kurzweil's technological singularity?
I understood McKenna's thing as singularity and novelty and all that stuff as to do with the information explosion. It was the point at which information doubled every second.
Mm-hmm.
And that was literally too, but yeah, so novelty became total, as in, you know, we would have more new stuff than we had old stuff at that point, constantly. Our knowledge or our information base would be expanding faster than we could assimilate it.
And then time would be essentially irrelevant, right, since everything was just sort of happening instantaneously.
I think it's another, like Phil was saying, it's just another of these stories that people make up. They get really clever and they get all this information and they start doing maps and grids and computer software, and they think suddenly they've cracked the riddle of the universe.
I've done it several times myself.
And I don't know, isn't it just as basic as people wanting to live in the future, people wanting to know or believe that the future is going to be better than the present somehow?
I guess the only difference is between, you know, a couple of guys sitting around smoking a joint and speculating on some crazy ideas is that here, or at least with the case with Kurzweil, this guy's a well-respected guy that's influential and powerful, and people listen to him and take his ideas seriously.
Yeah. Yeah, so wouldn't that come down to then, well, either you could say either, it may not be either or, but both and, but either he's tapped into the zeitgeist and he's figured out consciously or unconsciously what people want to hear and he's giving it to them, or those ideas are useful to certain agendas or agencies, and so they've been promoted, been embraced.
Yep. Yeah.
So maybe that's I shouldn't say our, because you guys maybe not aspiring to be a social influence like I am, but maybe that's my problem, is that I just haven't done anything useful. Powers that be.
But now you're going farther with Pentrogeny, and I wanted to talk to you a little bit about that.
Viva la evolution is what we say. Well, what I've done with Lady J, my other half, is take our bodies and cut them up. And then what is the resulting being, which only exists because of the two of us, is the Pandragine, or the third being. What seems to happen when you do that is that you begin to have a friendly relationship with synchronicity. The universe appears to begin to increase the odds of what you want to have happening. And that's something I can't speculate on why it happens, but it definitely has in my life. And so I haven't yet managed to have a dream that hasn't occurred. And that's kind of exciting, isn't it?
First century.
Bill, did you watch that Genesis Peorage video clip that I sent?
No, I did not. Sorry.
Because he calls himself a cultural engineer.
Do you know Dennis Peorage, Bill?
Not personally, but yes, I know him.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Transsexual, whatever that's
yeah.
the word for now. What's the correct word for...
Is there one?
Yeah, no, because he's, well, he's, I guess he's...
Pan...
What?
Is it pan, pansexual, or...?
Pansexual, no, but, I mean, he's given himself breasts, right? So he's actually had himself altered in order to be androgynous.
I thought it was no genital surgery, but in other, every other aspect to... make himself look even more like his, I believe, now dead ex-wife or girlfriend, whoever, whatever she was.
Right.
They both resembled each other very closely, I guess, and then he had plastic surgery to look even more like her, and that's the last thing that I heard. I don't know where he went with it after that.
I think he had breasts last time I saw.
Okay.
Yeah, so he does in the video.
I think you're probably right, there is no word for that, because it wasn't just about sex change, was it? He was actually trying to incorporate his other half into himself.
Yeah.
So to become complete.
I mean, in my opinion, this is just taking the whole, I guess, alchemical or divine androgyne concept just way, way too literally.
Yeah.
Which is surprising, because the guy is smart as fuck. Or guy, whatever.
The entity formerly known as a human being.
And as I said in the email, too, I mean, he's... conducting, you know, rituals with the process church as well, which is, I don't know, has he had a relationship with the process for a long time?
That's
or is that something
question.
Recent?
That's a good question. I don't
because
know.
Because it seemed like somebody sent me a song that that I got the impression it was from, that it was old, that it was maybe from the early 80s or something. That
Well, he was in this band called Throbbing Gristle, and I remember Throbbing Gristle, the concept, from being 12, 13 years old, because my brother had a small poster of theirs on his wall, and I used to sneak into his room sometimes. I'm not sure why, but I was always kind of freaked out by that poster and the title and everything. It was obviously very visceral, and it stayed with me. It was perhaps not entirely incidentally when I first heard Hunky Dory, David Bowie's album, was in my brother's bedroom around that period. There's something that piques my curiosity about it, because my brother, as you probably remember, was very anti-occult, as in very dismissive of it, and UFOs and God and you name it, just about everything except astrology, for whatever reason. Astrology got past his defenses, but nothing else. And he was particularly disparaging of any occult stuff, and Crowley and this and all, you know, any stuff that I was into. He scorned it. And I've wondered since then, for various reasons, if it was less to do with an absolute dismissal of, or, you know, scathing skepticism, than with some sort of direct experience that he had during that period. Because, you know, my brother, I mean, he tried everything, and he was definitely, he had a wall full of skulls, and he was, you know, saw himself as Luciferian, and He could easily be mistaken for an occultist, mm-hmm. by his way of life and his habits and his proclivities and even his art and whatnot. So, sort of temperamentally, you would think that he would be drawn to that world. And so, I think it's very likely that he was, and that he got involved with it to some degree, maybe even very early on, like when he was 18 or something, which would be this period that he had this Robin Gristle. And I'm pretty sure he did know those guys, Genesis Porridge. So, because of, you know, the how I've been looking at my past kind of in a new light, just wondering what might be in it, I've also wondered, if my brother didn't get drawn into that world at some point, and that was why he was so hostile towards my own interest in it. Maybe he was even sort of trying to protect me in a weird way.
That makes sense.
Because I think that, in a sense, without being too glib, I think that that what killed him was the way occult forces involved. I don't mean that in the woo-woo sense, but I mean in the sense that he did play with fire. Right? He'd be the first to admit that. That he experimented with everything, and that included, that would have started very early on, I think. Maybe even in his childhood, in the sense that he was interfered with in some way. Because these things, I mean, they do cross generations. They do have a sort of weird hidden life of their own. I think we've probably all seen evidence of that. Like if a person is drawn to that kind of material, there's something there already. There's some formative experience or some generational element, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say typically that's the case. The only other thing I would add to speculating on your brother is that he knew that it was sort of a defense mechanism, that he knew that there was something there, and it was kind of like his way of
keeping the door shut.
I think in some ways the same way he, you know, that his relationship with quote unquote God, I mean, he claimed to be an atheist, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, but well, I don't know. I mean, how many atheists have themselves crucified? Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, I asked my father about that, like what he thought of, because my father was an atheist too, and I asked him what he thought of having an atheist son who got crucified.
I just don't buy it.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and it kind of fits in with his whole persona of sort of self-created.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean,
phony. The authentic phony.
Lucifer has to deny, not just defy, but deny God in order to put himself forward as the only God. I mean, it's basic fundamental strategy, like the ego. And I guess back to transhumanism, this is what's going on there, and with Nietzsche also, like Nietzsche's God is dead, behold the Superman. Right? Ecce Homo was his autobiography, so Nietzsche did aspire to being that. Of course, he couldn't have created the idea or channeled the idea without awakening a corresponding aspiration within his own psyche to be it. Mm-hmm. Who was it? Did you text me recently? Was Nietzsche gay? ?
Yeah.
You got a new tidbit of rumor on the grapevine or?
Yeah, there was a whole article I found. This guy, nothing hard, no hard evidence, but but enough sort of colorings around that little pieces and tidbits that when you put them all together, it does seem actually pretty likely that he was. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that he was forced to hide it and because of the time.
And to compensate for it, apparently.
Right. Right. Some of his ideas about women.
And you know, the whole Dionysian thing.
And someone even mentioned that that whole famous quote of his about when going to see a woman, bring a whip. Mm-hmm. Someone was actually saying that, I don't know if this is true, but that he was into S&M and that was actually meant to be used on him, not on her.
Funny.
So, I don't know, but interesting.
Yeah, that inverts the whole story. It fits.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it does.
So why does he bring up Nietzsche again? Oh, the Superman, right. If God doesn't exist, it's necessary to invent him. That's a French saying. It's actually, if God did not exist, it would be necessary to invent him. And that was one of the statements or lines that we had to write out when we were punished at school. And I would always write it out. I would rewrite it. It was in French too. Since God does not exist, it is necessary to invent him. My atheist youth. So with the transhumanists, I mean, you could say, I mean, they would probably see it as, oh, God only knows actually what they would say, but, I mean, you're putting forward that nature boils a vacuum, so if God is dead, if a human being can no longer believe in the crucial fiction of a God, of a loving God, you know, a personal God, yep, then it has to fill that void by inventing one. But you could also see it as that they have to, and the desire to invent God or to become God is so strong that they have to slay the king in order to replace the king. So the transhumans have to destroy in their own minds the idea of a soul or the idea of the spirit in order to be able to create and invest in the fiction that consciousness can survive the death of the body through technology. That God isn't required for the mechanism.
Yeah. I ran across on that website that Julian sent a quote from Freud from Civilization and Its Discontents. It says, "With every tool, man is perfecting his own organs, whether motor or sensory, or is removing the limits to their functioning. Man has, as it were, become a kind of prosthetic god. When he puts on all his auxiliary organs, he is truly magnificent."
Actually, Edgar Allan Poe wrote a story about that. I don't know what it's called, like the man something something. And it was about a guy, it was one of his comic stories, which was always a bit broad, but it was about a guy who was all, was this general, you know, sort of powerful general type, and it turned out he was all prosthetic.
And in the website, he recounts the story from The Wizard of Oz, where the Tin Man was actually originally just a regular guy. He was a human being. Mm-hmm. But he begins to chop off, and this kind of relates to Bill's dream as well, the chopping off the limb. Mm-hmm. He starts chopping off body parts, and with each time he goes to a tinsmith and has the piece replaced until there's nothing left of him. He's a tin man. Fully technological.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's raising the question, inevitably, I guess, of where our identity lies. I mean, where is the self?
Yeah.
Motivation for any artist is look at me, Mum, isn't it?
Yeah.
And the point is that we all have fantasies of fame and greatness, and life for most of us is a process of gradually shedding those fantasies. The urge to be a hero is a reflex against the terror of death, and everybody in the world has those kind of fantasies.
And is it just an easily solved puzzle that you set about yourself, which is that this is just obviously all goes directly back to your parents?
I don't think you'd have to ask Freud about that, wouldn't you? I think you are what you are from day one, and I think dressing it up in that kind of... No, I don't really think that. I think that, as I said to you, the urge towards the light, which all of us have to make, I don't think that's a reflex against that, do you? I mean, I think it's frightfully common to be loved by your parents anyway. I'm grateful for the fact that I was neglected, because most of my kind of... my impulse is about rage and opposition and destruction and all that kind of thing.
Betrayal of the drama, degeneration. The sorrows we suffer have never worth
free. I'm Sebastian Horsley. And I'm an artist and a writer and a failed suicide.
I just thought it was more interesting collecting other people's heads than it was collecting stamps. To me, it's a more stylish suit. I keep trying to be miserable, but a kind of cheerfulness keeps spoiling it.
When I found out it was possible to be crucified in the modern world, I knew I had to do it.
I'd come off the cross. And I was utterly desolate. As far as I was concerned, the whole crucifixion had been a disaster. God had spat me out. He had punished me for being an atheist and a loser. I'm almost bankrupt. I either commit suicide or die by the age of 50, because I have said everything that there is to say.
Weary inside, now our hearts lost forever. Can't replace the fear nor the thrill of the chase. These rituals showed up the door for our wanderings. Open and shut. And slammed in our face.
So we might as well be extraordinary, because nothing matters very much and very little matters at all.
Unborn yesterday, dead tomorrow, miserable today. I am proof that God is a man.
I look at myself in the mirror because, let's face it, I'm my type. Yeah. The motivation for any artist is look at me, Mum, isn't it?
Yeah.
And the point is that we all have fantasies of fame and greatness, and life for most of us is a process of gradually shedding those fantasies. The urge to be a hero is a reflex against the terror of death.
Where have they been?
Well, I don't know if this is just what I want to believe, but I do think that letting go of ego and depression do seem to work together in some way. Mm-hmm.
So the letting go of ego corresponded with the beginning of depression or the end of depression?
Oh, it's too soon to say.
Okay.
Process isn't over yet.
One of the things that Jung, the way that Jung described depression was the ego being depressed into the unconscious. So, you know, as long as you resist that, of course, you will be suspended in that state of being depressed and not wanting to be in the unconscious and resisting it. And that, to me, is, I mean, I don't know if this is accurate or even true, but my personal feeling, intuition about my own depressed states is I sort of kind of enjoy them a bit because it allows me to just, like, give up and lay down and be depressed and just finally rest instead of constantly being active or worrying and thinking. And I enjoy them so much and give into them so much that they don't last very long, and I get very depressed and I can barely move for like an hour or two, and then it bottoms out and then it springs back up, and then suddenly the depression's gone and all of the negativity is gone. So giving into it seems to get me through it a lot quicker. But I start off hoping, now I'm going to go into it and I'm going to enjoy this week or two or three or a month or two or three of depression. but that's just giving into it just makes it end, you know? But I can't resist it any longer, so.
So what's the counter experience to that? If you do resist it, what's it like?
If I do resist it? Well, I would compare that to my darker periods, like the beginning of the sampan period when I was resisting where I was at and resisting where I found myself, and along with that experiencing a depression that would become very dark and would extend for long periods of time. And, you know, and that's when I would start thinking about suicide, homicide, what's the solution to this, trying to get out of it, trying to, you know, all the 1,001 different moves that you could possibly make to avoid this inevitable, inescapable situation that you found yourself in, squirming and trying to come up with one story or after another, or one fiction after another, one, you know, grand vision after another, and, you know, all of these failing, of course, because I really, you know, it seems to be that they're, all these fictions are futile. They're not really going to solve all these things. You're not going to solve all the issues. You're not ever going to evade and avoid where you're at. So it's complete acceptance. And then the end state of that was complete acceptance of where I was, no longer resisting. And then when that acceptance became, like, to me at least, it seemed to be a full acceptance, I could feel the depression break and then everything spring back up. And that's, you know, when I began to find possibilities and things and come back to life.
And so, it is a new kind of life, isn't it? It feels fresher and more vital.
Right,
For the heaviness that you've come through.
Right.
Yeah, I've had that experience many times. I'm in the process towards that now, fingers crossed, and I've just noticed how, I guess not for the first or even the 50th time probably, but how the tendency is, even though I also experience what you described, more and more I'm able to enjoy the depression and just sink into it, gratefully even. Mm-hmm. There's still some instinct, if that's the right word, or some trigger, some reactive mechanism that fights it, and what happens then is it ceases to be enjoyable, and I become more and more hostile, essentially, to my surroundings, more and more angry.
Fight, flight, ego struggling to preserve itself.
To survive, exactly.
A fiction struggling to survive, really, you know?
Yeah, and I think...
Not realizing that it can die 1,000 times over, it doesn't matter, it's just a story.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
you're identified with the fiction is what's going on, right?
Mm. Yeah.
And when the fiction is sending the message that it's in peril.
Yeah.
And then, but you're identifying with that fiction, so you think you're in peril.
Well, because once upon a time it wasn't a fiction, I think. Once upon a time, with those boundaries of the ego were so porous we were so liminal that actually to not to fight would have meant to die.
At one point, at an earlier point, those impulses that later become or can become destructive were helpful. The birth of ego is very early in the development of a child's personality, and you know, it comes at an important, at one point, those are useful things. Fight or flight, that is useful. That's self-preservation, you have to do that. But at a certain point, it all begins to break apart, and you can't really sustain it.
A quick question, with the porous nature, wouldn't that be a two-way street? So that your nature is porous, information can come in, but can it just as easily sort of pour out and exit? Or it doesn't really work that way?
Do you mean pour out as in you would lose it? Or as in
that it would just kind of fall?
Well, I think in a sense that, you know, if our self above and beyond just the surface of our body, that sensation, the sense of self that we get from that, our self comes from memories, right? So that's information that we store in our bodies, and I'm just thinking this as I'm saying it because of what you asked, if we were porous in that two-way fashion, then essentially if memories were just flowing through us, we wouldn't have a fixed sense of self. I mean, it's holding on to and identifying experiences that builds a self, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, maybe there is something to that, what you're saying, that, part of the process by which we develop a self in order to survive those crucial years, entails identifying with our story, and so we become misers of information.
Yeah, I mean, clinging to sort of memories or story, even the whole process of memory, it seems, is kind of a fear-based mechanism, because if you don't remember that poison plant,
mm-hmm.
You know, you're in trouble.
Yeah. Absolutely. In those early formative years, we do need to remember basic things, that fire is hot, ice is cold, you know, mummy is safe, the lion is unsafe, etc.
Right.
But after a certain point, you've more or less mapped your environment, and that's that. You don't actually need to file every little piece of data in order to maintain your defense system. But we, because of the trauma, overrides whatever natural mechanism and sabotages it, it becomes compulsive. So basically, yeah, I think this is quite true, clinging to every bit of memory and saying, this is me, this is me, this is me.
Uh-huh.
The other thing I want to bring up is the whole fight or flight mechanism. I mean, this is rooted in the reptilian or the R-complex portion of the brain, the amygdala. I mean, it's not just a sort of psychological concept. I think it's a biological reality.
That's why it's so powerful and impossible to really get beyond completely.
And from what I understand, the way this the brain works, the amygdala has certain connections to the neocortex, but they're one way. So when the amygdala gets fired up and it sends its fear signals to the neocortex, basically it subverts the higher thought process from functioning. But there's no corresponding traffic that where the neocortex can send messages to the amygdala to say, you know, chill, I got this.
It's only a one-way street. So.
Yeah. I think that's crucial. Actually, also, it was Joseph Chilton Pierce addresses that, I think, in that. He talks about the torus around the heart and how the only way to evolve as an individual is surrender, essentially, is to open the heart when the brain, or that part of the brain, the reptilian part, is screaming to the whole system to fight or flight, you know, run or fight, to actually override that, not through will, because that would be, that's hooked into the reptilian brain too. That's why, that's the thing, that it actually is, it is impossible, and yet somehow it can happen. It can't be done, but it can happen. It's like the Jesus thing of turning the other cheek and resist not evil. It sounds simple, but when you're slapped in the face, we all know what it's like, right? Living in a relationship is the really biggest test, I think. That it's just, no matter how many times we say to ourselves, I'm not going to react, we still react. Because it's pre-rational.
And when you don't react, I mean, it just happened to me today when we were driving in the car, and I didn't react, and the time seemed to just, like, stretch out. And I don't know how to describe it.
That's very interesting. What was going on while time was stretching?
It was just like this long, awkward pause where I just felt this intense pressure. And it felt like a miracle that I wasn't reacting. But I was just sort of suspended. But it was excruciating, because it just felt like it was lasting forever.
Mm-hmm. What was lasting forever, though? I mean,
sort of the silence, the fact that I wasn't reacting.
And what were you experiencing?
That excruciating stretching out of time.
I know, but in you, like, what was your sort of? Were you still angry? Were you just busy wrestling with desire to react during that whole period, or was something?
I was almost more amazed at the fact that I wasn't reacting. I was like observing that and just going, wow, what's going on? This is weird.
Yeah. Well, I think that does sound like that then. It is, it's almost like it is a miracle, like some sort of divine intervention.
Yep.
Because something has interceded, has come between the organism and that part of the brain that you're describing, that is screaming to every cell to act, to react. Something has intervened there. And it can feel like death. I mean, in most cases, it's just pride, really. I say just. It's pride, and that is hooked into is self-preservation. Pride, you know, I matter, I count, I have value. That, as an infant, if that isn't established, or if it isn't recognized, then you can die. But as an adult, it does just seem like ego when you're in it, or after you're in it particularly. But it's not, it's charged with so much more than just self-image, you know. So I think there was something, I don't know if I'll be able to get you now, but in all this, that we were talking about memory, establishing itself through memory, and I was thinking about astral projection, because that's the subject of the piece. You know, how astral projection is a way to get out of the body, so it can be a way to escape some intolerable reality in the body. And how there's two kinds of, in my experience, there's two kinds of out-of-body experience, one of which is quite common, and that's astral projection, in which I'm the same as I am when I'm in my body. Like my sense of myself, my set of memories is all the same. The only difference is that I'm experiencing myself as in some other state besides the physical. And I'm kind of dreaming awake, and I'm able to enter into visions and all that sort of stuff. I have never had an astral projection experience where I actually went and saw somebody do something, or that they were really doing, or looked down at my body or anything that I could corroborate. But essentially, it felt absolutely real to me, and I was conscious in the way I am now. The other kind of experience I had was much, much less common. In fact, I think I've only had it... I couldn't put a number on it, but in a really fully conscious way, I think twice, was when I entered into what seemed to be another, not just another non-physical state, but also another state, another self, really, not even just another consciousness, but it was like I was another self, and it was like being in another world rather than being in this world in a non-physical way. It was like I was in this other world that was, but wasn't even another world. It was more like I was experiencing my body as this tube of green light, and the energy of this tube was made up of memory. And the memory that was my sense of existing, this tube, this energy tube of memory, was far greater and varied from my ordinary set of memories. Mm. And I was just wondering, like in relation to all this, if what we're talking about, if like we were talking the other day about the luminosity. It was Phil and I. Remember, I was talking about Castaneda's stories and the memories of the luminosity.
Yep.
And we can't actually store them, and so we can't remember them, even though we're perceiving the experience of the luminous body every second. We can't store it, so we forget it in the moment we perceive it. So it's like it's not happening. So if we have this whole experience ongoing that's in our luminous body that is storing memories in some part of the body, but we can't access it with our mind, this may be our greater self, and it may not be limited to our physical self, our physical existence, and so it's not hooked into that part of the brain. It's not actually concerned with survival at any time. So it would be free of that desire to cling. Maybe that's why we can't remember it as well, because we're not storing the memories in the same way. We're just letting the experience pass through us and somehow inform us at some level. But because we've created this compartmentalized self through the defense system of the ego, which is just basically concerned with survival from day one right through to death for most people, that it's like we have these two separate selves. And so then I was wondering, like, if astral projection is the way that we've learned to escape intolerable reality, and you could even say that it has a survival thing, like if you have to sleep and there are predators around, you can astral project and watch over your body, right? I mean, mm-hmm. It's possible. Somebody yep. Learned to do that, and if they really needed to, like Aborigines and Dreamtime, maybe it does have a survival function, but it's hooked into the physical body and into that survival, blueprint, and so it is that experience still has to be run through the part of the reptilian part of the brain, and so essentially it's not any more free of the prison of the ego than we are normally. But then there may be this whole other experience that is much more rare, that is the what we're aspiring to, and that the astral projection thing is a surrogate for that. I'm just thinking how this ties into the kind of what gets covered in chapter 4. Like, there is a sense that we do exist beyond the body, that we are more than our bodies, that we are more than just a series of memories of the body. And so then there's this urge to try and transcend that, but because we're not able to get free of that, you know, because that part of the brain is just constantly controlling us, we end up splitting off instead of actually entering into the wholeness of ourselves.
I would think that that would relate to the unconscious. Is that your idea as well?
Yeah, I suppose, although I would say it was larger than, my experience in quotes, because it was the nature of the experience was so unusual. It wasn't as though while I was in it, because I remember kind of thoughts I was having when I was in this state, I wasn't thinking, oh my God, that's what happened when I was a child, or it was like I was accessing a set of memories that were completely separate, had been completely separate from my ordinary life.
Well, but I think that would be exactly how it would be experienced, because if it was a memory that you actually had stored in your conscious memory, then mm-hmm. then you would be able to recognize it. But if it was something that was never stored in your conscious memory, but was subconsciously or unconsciously stored, that you may not have even paid any attention to it at that time.
Yeah.
So it would appear to be something completely new.
Yeah. Well, I had a somewhat similar experience when I admittedly I was assisted by marijuana, but I had a waking flashback to being a child, and not to the same extent, but to some extent. The consciousness that I re-experienced from that time was qualitatively different. I mean, really drastically different. And specifically, how I remembered it, or how I experienced it, remembering it, was that I wasn't time-bound. That I remember being about 5 or 6, standing outside the neighbor's house, on the gravel. I think I was coming or I was leaving, so it was a totally trivial memory. There was nothing specific happening that would make it memorable. Saying hello or goodbye to somebody, and yet the memory of that, of being in that moment, it included memories of every other incident in my life up until that time. Like, it was a total memory. And so what it seemed to me was that at that age, I wasn't flattening out memories into a linear sequence. They were all happening simultaneously. And they were growing, but they weren't competing, but they were coexisting side by side. It was like a jewel, was the visual I got, like a jewel with these many facets. So one facet was that particular moment, but there were all these other facets, which were all the other moments that had preceded that moment, and they were all equally present in my awareness. So that may be the nature of the unconscious, in which case you're right, it would all seem unfamiliar because it would all be in a totally different context.
Be linear.
Be non-linear.
Yeah. I just came across this little factoid. I have no idea if it's true, but according to this Timothy Wilson person, he notes that the brain can absorb about 11 million pieces of information a second, of which it can process about 40 consciously.
Wow. That's crazy. Yeah.
So
yeah, it makes me think of autists, first of all, like if they're processing, you know, more like 40,000 or 6 million or whatever larger proportion of that information they're processing, then it would be correspondingly difficult for them to actually function while doing so. Was the first thing. Another thing was transhumanism, like we have computers to process information, and this kind of technology has the potential and is even being used to enhance our processing power, you know, to enhance our own senses, like we use technology to explore the ocean, for example. And in Strieber's The Key, he talks about how we already have the technology to detect the dead, we just don't know how to use it yet. So extraconsensual perception, if that has to do with perceiving or processing more of what the information the brain is receiving than just 40 bits a second, then technology could be used to actually enhance our capacity to experience reality. And that wouldn't be a bad thing, I think, because that would be more like an abacus. If you begin to see dead people through technology, pretty soon you'll learn to see them without it, I think. Because believing is seeing, to a large extent.
Yeah.
What do you think, Bill? That sounded quite radical.
Yeah, you sound like a transhumanist to me. I don't know if I'm talking to you anymore.
That's the only thing I have, but you have to ask yourself. Why would a child's immune system shut down? Okay, now here we go.
Well, I'm feeling kind of tired, so I guess maybe time to wind up.
Yep.
Alrighty.
Alright.
Any last words from anyone?
Just that I think that's... Is that, it's not a quote from Bainbridge, but you're talking about the Bainbridge... some Bainbridge piece here where he talks about employing cognitive neuroscience, genetic engineering, nanotechnology, and information systems. Those four things. I don't remember where I came across those four things in the past. Perhaps it was Bainbridge. They just kind of repeated in my mind for weeks after that, where I just was so, I mean, it created such a crystallized vision in my head of these four elements coalescing.
Well, you started planning your rosy future right there.
the total opposite, man. Where I just started realizing, my God, if these four things ever fully fuse into a unified agenda, we're in deep shit.
Yep. Well, you have kids, so it's that's a whole different consideration. Phil and I, we've only got a few decades to survive.
Yeah, and then at best.
You just ride it out, huh?
Yes, it may. Yeah, we've got reincarnation to consider. We could be coming back to William Sims' nightmare utopia. It's also a possibility, I suppose.
I ain't happy. I'm feeling glad I got sunshine. In a bag, I'm useless, but not for long. The future is coming on. I ain't happy. I'm feeling glad I got sunshine. In a bag, I'm useless, but not for long. The future is coming on. It's coming on. It's coming on. It's coming on. It's coming on.
And this is hard for me. I will honestly tell you this. Everything that involves sexuality is hard for me. And there was a lot of it in my experience with the Greys, far more than I have ever described. And I'm not exactly a prude, but I am a very conventional person. when the world becomes reconciled with the Greys, and by reconciled, they're hard.
In a bag, I'm useless. Not for long, the future is coming on. Hey, happy, I'm feeling glad I got sunshine. In a bag, I'm useless. But not for long, the future is coming on. It's coming on, it's coming on, it's coming on, it's coming on.
They know absolute morality, and they live by it. And it's vividly important to get involved with it and to understand. And you don't have to. I mean, I'm hoping, obviously, at the Stargate, we will have some kind of contact experiences. I can't guarantee it, unfortunately. Knowing the Greys, they'll stay away on purpose because I want them to come. But nevertheless, you can get involved even if you've never had a close encounter experience at all.
Well, remember that it's all in your head. Hey, it happened. I'm feeling glad I got sunshine. In a bag, I'm useless. Not for long, the future is coming on. Hey, it happened. I'm feeling glad I got sunshine. It's coming on, 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 our future. It's coming on, it's coming on, it's coming on, our future. It's coming on, it's coming on, it's coming on, our future. It's coming on, it's coming on, it's coming on, our future.
The little farm animal grazing happily lifts his head and sees the stars, and that's because partly he is drawn by the wonder that they bring, and partly he is forced by the kicks that they give.
I don't believe that for a minute. It's bullshit. How do I know that? Because it is bullshit. Sing that song to somebody else. It's a feeling of being under absolute control. I'm really not buying this. You can show me all those little insignia and everything else, and I'm still just not buying it.